Welcome to the Michaela Peterson Podcast. This is episode 13. For today's episode, I spoke with Michael Malice. Michael Malice is the author of Dear Reader and The New Right, and the host of You're Welcome and Nightshade. He's the subject of the book Ego and Hubris by Harvey Pekar. Michael's a really interesting human. I was told to have him on the podcast by Dave Rubin, so I reached out to him right away after our episode. His book, Dear Reader, is an autobiography of Kim Jong-il. You heard that right. He traveled to North Korea and wrote an in-first-person biography of Kim Jong-il. So we spoke about North Korea, and things got pretty random after that. I sent him a personality test, and he showed up as 0th percentile in politeness. My dad has a personality test that I absolutely adore at understandmyself.com. It's 10 bucks or something, and it gives you an accurate portrayal of your personality. I also score 0th percentile in politeness, but 89th percentile in compassion. Both of those are facets of the trait agreeableness and personality. I believe you can use the code Michaela to get some money off of it if you're interested, or you can just give it to your significant other to see if they're a sociopath. Also, just so you're prepared, I identify as a libertarian, not a libertarianism. Please forgive me. Oh, audience, enjoy the episode. I don't think I've laughed this much in 8 months. Okay, Michael Malice. Welcome to my podcast. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I get started usually with podcasts with getting the guest to tell my audience a little bit about them. Like, who are you?
I am the subject of a book by the late Harvey Pekar. The book's called Ego and Hubris. I am an author. People know me from my previous book, Dear Reader, the unauthorized autobiography of Kim Jong-il, which is the entire history of North Korea in one easy-to-read format. My most recent book was called The New Right, A Journey to the Fringe of American Politics, which described the anti-progressive coalition that culminated, in a sense, with the Trump victory, and that still maintains a lot of cultural influence today. And I am a Twitter troll, I think, and a lifelong New Yorker. I think that's kind of the, that covers pretty much. Oh, and I host two shows, You're Welcome with Michael Malice and Nightshade, which is on my nightly news wrap-up show on Compound Media.
Okay. I brought you on because I had a podcast with Dave Rubin and he said, you have to get Michael Malice on. And I didn't know of you before he said, you have to get Michael Malice on.
I didn't know of you either. So how's it feel?
I'm okay with it. I'm okay with it.
Well, I'm not.
Well, I did a bit of scrolling through your Twitter.
Yeah.
You're not sorry. You're just saying I'm sorry.
I'm trying to be Canadian.
Oh, okay. Well, you don't have enough drawl in the sorry. Okay. It's sorry.
All right, I'll figure it out.
Anyway, I definitely know you well. I didn't know of you, but going through your Twitter, I can definitely see you're a troll. So I wanted to start a bit with that. And I guess, how do you judge? Do you care if what you're trolling is appropriate or if you're hurting people's feelings? Or do you think that what you're doing online, the people that you're bothering online are worthy of bothering?
Well, worthy is can have a lot of different meanings. If you're asking, should you feel bad about hurting people who deserve to be hurt, the answer is no. There's two types of people in this world. There's Superman and Batman. And Superman's job is to help the good people, and Batman's job is to hurt the bad people. And I think there's a lot of nastiness and toxicity in social media, and some people only respond to speaking their own language. Now, at the same time, if I'm clowning you on Twitter, that's not nefarious. Like, anyone who has some healthy self-esteem will enjoy being the subject of a joke and will be entertained by it. So I think trolling has a, and trolling is in the term, and I use trolling in a pretty specific way, not in the sense of just being a jerk, because as terms reach the mainstream, they lose their kind of specificity. I use trolling to mean exploiting someone's weaknesses to turn them into an unwitting performer. And trolling is a very effective mechanism towards eliminating power hierarchies, because a lot of people who presume to have authority over you or presume to have dominance or power, it's a bluff. And when you call them on your crap and you expose them, very quickly any such power is removed. And this is also a useful mechanism because people like that are very effective at bullying others. So if you can kind of pull their pants down and have them be exposed, it's a very useful social technique as well.
Yeah, that's fair. I wrote a paper on, not a paper, an article on trolling. I got totally destroyed like last September from, I don't know if you can even call like vegans, I guess anybody can troll, but I got attacked by somebody with a huge vegan following. So I wrote an article on what trolling was and why it's effective and comedic. And it depends, right? Because there's trolling, sure, and then there's just being an asshole.
Yeah. There's no creativity no wit.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is different.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, well, your Twitter is very entertaining.
Well, thank you.
And like, necessary, I think.
Yeah, I enjoyed it immensely. And as my platform has gotten bigger and bigger, it's given me bigger and bigger targets to work with, and to the amusement of many and to the detriment of some.
Yeah, yeah, fair. Okay, so one of the things I'm interested in, I think mainly, is your experience in North Korea. You wrote a book about it. Well, an biography, but...
Autobiography.
Is it?
Yeah, it's Kim Jong-il's... It's right here. It's Kim Jong-il's... here we go. It's Kim Jong-il's life story as told from his words. So what I did is I went to North Korea and I got all their literature. And Kim Jong-il in North Korea, he's Kim Jong-un's father. And his father, Kim Il-sung, was the founder of North Korea. He's their Forrest Gump. So anything that happened in North Korean history, according to their mythology, he was there and he was a witness to. So by having him tell his story, he's effectively telling the reader the entirety of North Korean history from their perspective. And it was very grueling to put this in kind of a very beach read. I want it to be light because most of the literature about North Korea is either too academic. Yeah. Or it's too intense. I mean, this is the worst place on earth. The things they do to their population is nightmarish. So to have it be this kind of light farcical tone was very hard. And to have all that information packed in there was no mean feat.
So how did that come about? Like, how did you end up doing that, going to North Korea in the first place?
You've never been? It's the new Milan. No, yeah. I was on my friend Ed, who I went to college with, who I am going to take every opportunity to disdain, because it turned out when we were in college, he spread the rumor that I had AIDS. I only found out about this years later. I was on his Facebook. It's not true. In remission. I was on his Facebook, and it was his big dopey face in Kim Il-sung Square with the North Korean tanks behind him. And I'm like, what is going on? And he said, yeah, it's legal. Like, he had met a guy in Burning Man, of course. And there are tours where it's illegal now, but at the time, you just got to give them a ton of money and you're allowed to be a tourist to North Korea. Now, this was something that they fought kicking and screaming. During his lifetime, Kim Jong-il said, we don't want hordes of tourists coming in here, bringing forth pollution and spreading AIDS. That's an actual quote from him. But after the end of the Cold War, when North Korea was no longer a welfare state of China and the Soviet Union, they had very little to offer the outside world and they needed hard currency. And one of the few things that they could do is bring people over there and show them around. So it was legal. I went there in 2012. This is the kind of thing people say all the time, but I think people will forgive me for the cliche. It is a life-altering trip, especially because every single person who I saw, everyone I saw, is still there. I still see my guide on Instagram. They're all prisoners of this, you know, nightmare regime. So when you realize how much your life has changed in the last 8 years, anyone listening to this, think about it, and they're all trapped. You start to understand that when it comes to North Korea, the only issue at hand isn't Trump, it isn't his Kim Jong-un's sister, is what does this mean for the continuing enslavement of the 25 million North Korean people who had in the past been regarded as a bit of a laughingstock? Thanks to my work and many others, people have kind of understood now that this is perhaps humorous in the sense of absurdity, but not humorous in the sense that these are silly people putting on a show, because they realize, wait a minute, if someone put a gun to my kid's head, I'm going to be putting on a song and dance real fast and proudly so, and I'm not even going to hesitate.
Yikes.
Yeah.
So do you think part of the reason you do the, well, trolling on Twitter is, I mean, this might sound a bit dramatic, but the way things are going politically in America, I've had people who were in the USSR reach out to me anyway and say, hey, some of the actions that people are doing now seem similar to what was going on in the USSR. So do you think part of the reason you're trolling is because of your experience in North Korea, or have you always been kind of humorous and pokey?
I was born in the USSR, so I'm very familiar with what they're saying. And I would disagree, because I would argue that the USSR techniques have been here for decades. And it is now only that mask has been dropping and people are more aware that this sort of duplicity and chicanery has been going on in the States for a long time. We are simultaneously told in the States that McCarthyism, which is the one time that leftists were canceled, was the darkest thing that ever happened in America, but also the era that is most necessary to emulate. We're being told with a straight face that the Senate Majority Leader is and the president are both taking orders directly from Moscow, and no one seems to find this ironic or have any pushback to make these kind of brazen claims. Whereas at the time, when there are people who were taking orders from Stalin with the gulags, with the Holodomor, with the secret police, and trying to install Stalinism in this country, the fact that they couldn't get gigs as screenwriters is still portrayed as the greatest injustice in history. I mean, that's the level. So this is not new. That's the level of depravity of what we're up against. And thankfully, thanks to social media, just like Samizdata in the Soviet Union, when you have a democratization of information and a democratization of reporting and exchange of ideas, it is very hard to have a monopoly narrative and monopoly control of history and the present day. And we see it. An example of this is the New York Times, which is very much an enemy agent. They are explicitly and publicly engaging in a coup against our nation's history with their 1619 project. They are redefining, and I'm using that term advisedly, America as having been founded with the Founding Act being slavery. Now, if you are going to say, and this is a valid position from their perspective, that America is a nation that is definitionally about slavery, a lot of your argument is taken care of, because everything else just follows suit like dominoes. So the fact that they are having to do this publicly, the fact that people are calling them out on their crap, including many historians, including many leftist historians, is a great example of why I'm very optimistic about the future of our country. They have to now engage in their antics under the full daylight of social media, which they cannot abide.
That's actually a really good point. That is a really good point, though, because, like, well, my dad's been on about, got made fun of a couple of years ago about like Marxism making its way into society, and everyone's like, oh, like, that's not real. But that totally makes sense. And at least now there is social media, and you can't censor it. Well, you can censor it, but it's much more difficult to censor.
Right.
Okay, so back to North Korea. Do you, like, in your book, do you have any suggestions about what can be done? Or is there anything that can be done for that kind of regime?
I am someone, let me bring up an example I recently learned from Marianne Williamson, who was a presidential candidate in 2020. She's regarded as new age. She's this kind of self-help guru. And I read her book, and she had something in it that I found extremely profound. She was a speaker in LA during the 80s, during the AIDS crisis. And she has a very disproportionately gay audience. A lot of gay men came to her classes and they were dropping like flies. And she was in a position as this, you know, healer to try to offer them hope when no one cared, when there was no cure on the horizon, when men at age 27, the prime of their life, are dropping like flies. I mean, to have hope for this is kind of an absurdity. It's going to look, you know, fallacious on its face. And what she said to them, she goes, how about this? How about instead of saying we're going to get a cure tomorrow, what if we get it to the point where it's like diabetes, right? You're going to live a long life. They cut off your feet. You go blind. Is that unrealistic? Should people with diabetes just kill themselves? If we get to, is that really that nuts? So, and I bring that up all the time because that's such a great way of having hope and looking at realistic and possible futures. If you tell someone who's homeless, like, you know, heroin addict, like, you're going to be a millionaire, you're going to be a lawyer, a doctor. Cool, cool. If you tell them, you know what, you might have to have a sucky job and have a roommate you don't like for a year. It's like, oh, I could do that. That's not really so bad. And compared to what I have now, that's a miracle. So in terms of my book, bringing this back to North Korea, I have no idea. All I knew how to do as an author and someone who knows how to run his mouth is to take where the camera was on Kim Jong-un and Kim Jong-il as clown figures and move it a little bit. And I say, it's like the Joker in, you know, Batman. Look at this clown. But behind that clown, you have lots and lots of corpses with the blood on his hands. And that's where the focus, the literal focus of that camera needs to be. Not on this clown, but on the people behind him. What happens next? I have no idea. And I can think of many reasons why there isn't good options. There are no good options for North Korea, including for the North Korean leadership, because it's like riding a tiger. When you take your hand off of that tiger, you're the first one who's going to be personally have a bullet put in you, and with good reason. So it's bleak. All I knew how to do is provide information and try to encourage both empathy and sympathy for the North Korean population, which is very easy for us in the West to dismiss, both because of this low-key anti-Asian racism, oh, Asians are weird, and the fact that so few people escape out of there to be able to speak for them. And once you kind of start talking to people just on a very basic level, it's, if I found, it's very quick how people snap out of it and they're like, oh my gosh, this is so horrible. How did I ever, you know, look at this with any sort of bemusement?
Yeah. A couple of years ago, I don't remember, I think it went viral online, but it was a cartoon from people who had left North Korea, and it was cartoon drawings of what they'd experienced in North Korea. I don't remember when it was, maybe 2014 or something. And it was horrible. And I sent it around to some of my friends because it was horrible. And some of them were like, no, that's not, there's no way that's real. It's like, that's like the.
And the thing people need to understand is they are not robots. It would be a lot easier if it worked and they had all been dehumanized and it's like a country of androids. But the fact that I know refugees and they're the most vapid, boring people you could ever want to meet, just like everybody else, makes it, you know, all I ask for the North Korean population is that they have a recliner that they can sit in, filling with their farts like the rest of us, watching stupid television and having their beer. That's it. They don't need to have, you know, spaceships. They don't need just food and not to have to be afraid of that knock on the door in the middle of the night. And when you realize that these are human beings with, I did an article about my trip for Reason Magazine. I called it My Week in North Korea. And the first line was, how do you make a North Korean laugh? They have a great sense of humor. And a dark set, I mean, the refugees have a very dark sense of humor. I met one refugee and she said her favorite movie and book was The Hunger Games. Because she's like, oh, it was like being back home. How did they know what it was like? And I'm like, am I allowed to laugh at this? Another refugee I knew, it was just amazing about the human mind, just speaking more broadly. We were walking in New York and it was one of those New York winters and the winds were through the, you know, just insane. And, you know, we're trying to get to the train. And I turn to him and I'm like, weren't you homeless for a year living on the mountainside? And it's amazing. And he had been. And your reality can change from that is the normal to now that it's like, oh, it's 30 degrees. I can't bear this. It's just fascinating to see how easily and quickly they transition to a normal, liberal sense of life. And that should give us all hope, but that should also pain us that this is being done to this population. And it's a country where by law, it's family, Punishment. The great leader Kim Il-sung said class enemies must be exterminated for three generations. So if someone commits a crime in North Korea, three generations of your family are punished and you don't know who did it. So it's there's so many levels of hell. And I go through it in the book because this didn't happen overnight. This was a systemic laying of oppression by this family over this nation for decades. And little by little, they just twisted the screws and ended up with the situation that they have today. There's nothing else like it. It's really bothering to me also, just to ramble a little bit, when you hear Western analysts and they try to conflate it with China or try to conflate it with Russia or, you know, Iran or something like that. It's like it's its own unique animal. This is something they boast about, how unique they are. But when you sit down and you study what has been done to this nation, it's just mind-bogglingly chilling.
Okay, so how did you learn all this? I mean, it can't just have been like, what was your week there like? Was your week there chilling?
It's impossible. First of all, there's no internet access. There's no access to outside information, right? So, and they take your cell phones at the plane, at the airport. There's no way to convey to anyone else, and it's hard for me to even explain, what it's like to be in a country with no access to the outside world, with no ability to have an ATM, the internet, news. Time. The headlines are the same every day. Dear leader opens up, you know, new farm. There's no sense of time. It's not possible to convey what that's like, where every day is the same, and it's almost like dreamlike in a way. It's very disturbing. When you're in a capital city, Pyongyang is their showcase city. They have something like a social credit score, which determines where you can live in the country. So people who aren't reputable in the government's eyes aren't allowed to even step foot in the capital city, right? So these are the best of best. But you're in a capital city with skyscrapers. And they don't really have electricity. It's just so weird to see that, you know, at night where these buildings are half lit. And the thing is, because it's an artificial nation, it's central planning. Everything you see is there by design, right? But like any other city, but that's more decentralized. And you're looking around and you're trying to have things that are analogous to what you've experienced or maybe you've experienced other countries. And some things I know why this is like this. But others, you know, you're not going to be able to make heads or tails of it. And you're not really going to be in a position to ask for explanations either.
Interesting. There was nothing... How do I ask this? Like, was there anything fun on your trip or was it just creepy?
Oh, it was a lot of fun. The people try to do their best to have happiness in this most unhappy place. And what I did, being an obnoxious Brooklynite, is every single person I saw, I got in their face and waved. Because I knew as a tourist, I'm allowed to get away with being a jackass. Yeah. But what that showed me, because not everyone's good at improv, was sincere reactions from the population. And people waved back, girls giggled, grandmas, you know, with their grandkids, you know, hugged them close, were very proud, look at her. Teenage boys with their Adidas tracksuits rolled their eyes and turned their heads. But you saw the entire gamut of perfectly universally expected human behavior. Here's the thing. This is my tip I wrote in my article, and I'll tell everybody else. If you go to North Korea, just take every racist joke you know and replace the punchline with Japanese, and they will be on the floor in hysterics because their loathing for the Japanese is pervasive. So if you say, how do you stop a Japanese man from drowning? Take your foot off his neck. Oh, they will just... be crying, laughing. Every single joke you can think of, just take it and put Japanese. And because the people don't understand the West, their entire mythology is based on racial purity and that the Korean race is the only pure country on earth. Every other country has been mixed. So in many ways, they're far closer to fascists than they are to communists.
Well, how do they feel about South Korea, though?
South Korea, so North and South Korea, they regard as one country that is indivisible, and that Korea has been the first country on earth. Korean was the first language ever spoken. Korea was the first government. So since Korea is one, that's their slogan, whenever you're in North Korea, they show a map of Korea as one unified country. And they write North Korea with a lowercase n, South Korea with a lowercase s, because South Korea is not a separate country. It is a region under occupation by the U.S. imperialists. Now, by law, whenever they refer to the Japanese or to Americans, they have to use a slur. So it was very funny to me when I was reading their books, and it'll be talking about history, but it'll be like, in 1905, the wicked Jap devils, blah, 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 blah. And it'll be, but like, that's how they talk, or the Yank bastards, wow, or things like this. So it's a mechanism of social control, whereas you can't talk about these other populations indifferently, even if you wanted to. It's built into the language and the jargon itself. So they have an enormous affinity for the South Korean people. In fact, one of the people on my tour with me was of Korean descent. And in North Korea, it's very big on culture to have these overt displays of emotion that's not fake. And, you know, one of the people we met was crying. She's like, I feel like I'm meeting my son. Because you have to also appreciate these two nations have been separated since the 1940s, including some families. And anyone who goes on YouTube and looks up Korean family reunions, people who hadn't seen each other for decades, fathers and daughters, brothers, you are going to cry your eyes out at how disturbing it is that these families have been separated. The only reason is the evil North Korean regime keeping them from contacting their family members. And even worse, if they are talking to foreigners, that is extremely politically suspect and can have profound consequences for you and your family.
That's so awful. Like you can talk about it, but being separated from your family and not able to contact them, just that is so awful.
It gets even worse. So I'll tell you another story. There was a North Korea's engaged in lots of terrorism and provocative behavior over the decades. At one time, they sent a hit squad to South Korea, to the Blue House, where the South Korean president lives, in an attempt to murder him. The South Korean security guards, you know, got wind of this. They took out most of the North Koreans, shot them. One guy saw what was happening, one North Korean. He stayed behind, and he just got captured by the South Koreans. Because he didn't kill himself or, you know, die in the line of duty, They took his parents in North Korea, took them into a stadium and publicly executed them as a lesson for him. So it's however bad you think it is, like people think it's bad because they have to learn stupid things at school and perform in a play once a year. Like if it was just that, it would be a paradise compared to what they have to go through.
That's, well, no wonder that sounds like the Hunger Games.
Yes, yes. It's and the fact that this is happening on our Earth, the fact that they have concentration camps that you can see right now on Google Earth. And, you know, we always talk in school, how is that allowed to happen? Well, you know, they've got 200,000 people roughly in these camps right now, and no one knows what to do about it. And I'm not saying people have an easy answer. They don't. But the first step is to be like, guys, this is happening right now, and has been happening for a long time. And the least you can do is just have some sympathy for this population, which most people do, to be fair.
Yeah, or at least admit it's happening.
Yes.
So what's this generational punishment? Can you delve into that a little bit?
Sure. So again, this is a very kind of old school Asian idea that, you know, families are responsible instead of having this Western kind of individualism, right? So in the camps, it's written on the walls, you know, the class enemies must be exterminated through a few generations. And I don't know that there's that much more to explain. They don't really have this kind of court system. There's no Miranda rights. You know, they're not brought in front of a court and you have some kind of, you know, legal defender. Basically, you know, the order comes down and three generations get taken and people get sent to the camps. And the scary thing is, which is shocking for us to believe, a lot of people who go to those camps aren't sent there for life. They're sent there for a finite period, and then they're allowed to reintegrate into North Korean society. They have to sign an NDA, but some of them, you know, break it. And there's a book called Aquariums of Pyongyang about someone who escaped, who was from Pyongyang, a very prominent family, got sent to the camps, then was later released. And some people remember during the early 2000s, George W. Bush had the axis of evil as Iran, Iraq, and North Korea. And North Korea took great umbrage at this because they're like, what do we have to do with Iran and Iraq? And part of the reason he had such a contempt for that country correctly is because he had read that book and it was so disturbing to him, as it would be disturbing to anyone who reads it. It's just shocking what sort of things happen to people in that country.
Okay, well, that's horrifying.
Yeah.
And so they don't allow people in anymore.
Well, no, now America banned it. So they still do allow people in. They're still, they have a lot of tourism from China. They don't get along particularly well with the Chinese tourists because the Chinese tourists apparently treat them kind of like rednecks and like trash and talk down to them. So this is a source of contention. But still, they're not doing so hot. Let's just put it that way.
Wow. Okay. Well, anyway, that was fun.
Yeah, it's a hoot.
Yeah, that sounds, not good. Let's switch topics then. North Korea, is not a hoot. I would put you in the category of people who are involved in the intellectual dark web.
Am I officially inducted in?
I don't know. Dave Rubin said, get Michael Malice on your podcast and I just assume anyone who's involved with him could be put in the IDW class.
Really? You think Candace Owens is IDW?
I don't know how I feel about Candace Owens. Okay, this is off topic. Okay. But have you seen, and I want to know what your opinion on this, have you seen what's been going on with Chrissy Teigen on Twitter?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, are your thoughts on that?
A follower of mine had a great tweet, which is that Pizzagate aged better than Russiagate. I think what we saw with Jeffrey Epstein and Amy Robach with ABC News should have shaken everyone to their core and been profoundly disturbing when she's caught on a hot mic talking about how they had the receipts on everybody. We know for a fact that there's been this kind of international child sex trafficking. I don't at all suspect Chrissy Teigen of being involved in any capacity. I've been following to that extent, to be fair. But I do want to make clear that and this is another thing coming from being born in the Soviet Union. American, and I made this point in Rogan, Americans have this very naive idea about what corrupt power means. They think it means I'm going to hire my brother as a construction gig and pay him double the money and get rich that way, or like Hunter Biden. That's not what it means. Corruption means doing things that if we learned about it, we would all consider it just absolutely depraved. And that they relish in the fact that they're getting away with this depravity. A great example of this is, which is not in dispute, so no one can get upset about this in that sense, is Roman Polanski. He drugged and raped an underage girl. He fled to Florida, to France to escape punishment in the United States. And he's still not radioactive in Hollywood. I mean, that in and of itself should make everyone scratch their head and be like, wait a minute, Paula Deen's career was ruined because she used the worst racial slur decades ago. He drugged and raped an underage girl, and you are still talking about this guy as if he's a badass. And when you see that, it's like, okay, I don't know what's going on behind closed doors, but I know that it's not the kind of thing where I could roll my eyes and shrug my shoulders at.
Yeah, that's fair. I have no idea what's going on there. I looked at Chrissy Teigen's tweets and I thought, okay, so I think she's funny. I don't know if I'm allowed to say that, but I think she's funny. And her tweets, they're like, in 2011, nobody cared about them because people just thought they were funny. And now right. It's like, oh, she mentioned a kid and now there's this thing to jump on. So going back to Candace Owens, I think she's great for speaking her mind, but also I wasn't really on board with the whole the right wing people trying to cancel Chrissy Teigen. And Chrissy Teigen, maybe she's annoying in some respects, but she's also funny and she's also just a person. And I'm not a fan of canceling anybody regardless of, especially for tweets a while ago that were kind of funny. Anyway, that's my opinion on that. It's I don't know if I like Chrissy Teigen, but some of her tweets were funny and she's just getting destroyed by right wing, super right wing trolls, I would say, on Twitter, destroyed. She deleted 28,000 tweets and people are like, well, that proves that she's a pedophile. It was like, maybe she doesn't want to be attacked on every thread. Like,
yeah, you know, like if you're on your phone while you're taking a dump and you have a thought, like, you don't need to bring it up 9 years later and be like, what did you mean by this? I meant I was in the bathroom.
Yeah. Right? It's like, yeah. You can't even delete them. They still exist. Freaking Twitter. I hate Twitter.
Oh,
it's growing
it.
On me. It's like, the older I get, the more I like Twitter. I don't know what that says about Twitter or me, but slowly moving from Instagram to Twitter.
I'm not an Insta fan because I'm not verified on Instagram. So, you know, F them. And plus, I don't like that they tell you what you can and can't see. I want to see everything from everybody in chronological order. That's it. It's not hard. And Instagram doesn't allow you that.
Do they order things?
They disorder them. Instagram. And also, they won't show you everyone's pictures.
See, I don't know anything about this.
Yeah, but Twitter, so far, they claim they don't shadow ban. They do, but it's nowhere near the extent that Instagram does it.
Really?
Yeah. And that's probably going to change.
The same?
Facebook's even the worst. Facebook's the worst. They have no pretense that they're going to show you a lot of things. And the fact that you can't even have that as an option is why I left Facebook. I'm on Ruben's site, locals, mouse.locals.com, specifically for that reason. I think Facebook has become increasingly what people say Twitter is, in the sense of being very toxic and a place where people engage in really vitriolic arguments. And it's even worse because it's from people who are connected in some capacity. And I think that's very bad for mental health. I think it is demented to judge the quality of your relationship with someone based on your shared political views. It's kind of like when you're in junior high and think, I'm going to go out with this girl because we like the same music. I mean, it makes sense when you're 14. When you grow up, you're like, this is a very weak metric for determining the quality of a relationship.
Yeah. So you think Facebook's worse than Twitter?
Oh, by far.
Really?
Oh,
just because
far,
there's a connection between people. Yeah.
I think, yes, I think it's also more argument focused because you can go on these big speeches. I think it's and on Twitter, everyone is there's an egalitarianism about it, which I usually am averse to. But the fact that I can, you know, call out Lawrence Tribe as just this nasty, demented old man to his face, and there's nothing you can do about it, is really kind of amazing. Whereas on Facebook, it's very easy to have your settings so only your friends can comment.
Ah, okay, that's funny. I have a different experience. Like, I find, just for the social medias I'm on, I don't go on Facebook really. Like, my main platform probably is Instagram, and then now that I'm doing podcasts, YouTube. I like YouTube. But Facebook I found was more personal. So it was, if anyone was going to attack me, it was friends, and that hurt more.
Yes.
But Twitter, like, it's hard to manage to mute enough people.
Oh, you got to block them.
Like, I just mute them. I don't
know. No, but then they're driving away the people you want. Do you flush the toilet or do you leave it there and close the lid? You have to create your own boundaries.
So I suppose. Yeah, I know. But then doesn't that... Yes, but I feel like that kind of like swerves into censoring a little bit. Like, I don't want to delete that if that's what people think. I just don't want to see it because it makes me feel ill.
Freedom of association is integral to mental health. It's integral to self-progress. And if you have a party, you have a guest list, maybe friend of a friend. But if someone comes in there and they're being obnoxious, there are people whose only role is to spread toxicity and aggressive banality. If you're going to be aggressive, be creative about it. If you're going to be contrarian or argumentative, bring something to the table. If not, it's going to alienate the people that you want surrounding you. I've had a great experience on Twitter because of this, and I advocate for this very heavily. And my audience, like when I do my shows, you know, the people come on, they're always surprised at the quality of the interaction from my crowd because, I very heavily feel the need to weed my garden and to keep out people who I do not have a presumption of interaction. My presumption is of disinterest and separation. I don't think most people have anything to bring to the table.
How did you get to that? Because that's not how I viewed people at all until, I don't know, only recently, I guess, I started talking to people thinking that they were actually different from me. It took me at least until I was 20, I would say like only a year ago, so 27, till I realized, people aren't the same as me. I literally went around thinking, assuming people were the same as me. And turns out I'm fucking weird, which I didn't know until I was 27. So how did you get to the point where you realized, I don't know, what the average person is like?
I went to yeshiva as a kid. I was an immigrant. And when you go to yeshiva and, you know, you're raised in this certain kind of ideological mindset, and then you go from there to public school, which I did in fourth grade. And I learned what, like, and because the focus was so scholarly, so much in education and so much, you know, in certain things. And then I went to public school and I saw what the average person was like. I was like, holy crap. It was a very kind of disturbing thing. And then also too, when you hear, I've always been an outlier, so I've never felt normal. I didn't regard it. Sometimes it's a bad thing. Sometimes it's a good thing. But the kind of things that you see people say politically, you know, with a straight face and just repeat, once you notice it and take that red pill, you can't untake it. And then it just is like, oh, okay. It's very liberating when you realize you don't owe anyone an explanation or engagement or any kind of interaction, and that the odds are going to be pretty low that you're going to get anything out of an exchange other than having them as a source of amusement.
Wow. I'm still definitely not at that level. But
you'll get there. You're young.
Yeah, right. I'm not as jaded as I should be. I don't know why
it's
I'm not
being
jaded.
It's not being jaded. You just
realistic.
I mean, you eat at the best restaurants, you read the best books. I mean, those books are rarer, but that doesn't mean that they're it's just a statement of a fact. I mean, to expect people to not be otherwise is something we're trained to believe, but is not based on data. Like if you go to a bookstore, right, 90% of those books are crap. That doesn't mean that those 10% are the only ones that matter. Those 10% of the books are what validate all literature. It doesn't make you jaded. It's just, you know, kind of like it's not a numbers game. I'm not a Democrat in either sense.
I don't know. I just assume... And I think I'm wrong. I really do think I'm wrong. But I assume that everybody I talk to, like I said, is the same as me. So I've got quite a bit of drive to work and to earn money and to read and to learn. And I'm on a really strict diet. And like I'm fairly disciplined. And so I meet other people. And if they're not as disciplined, I just automatically am annoyed. Like, well, why aren't you trying harder? And
yeah.
Sometimes it's because they're literally not as disciplined. It's not their fault. They just are that way.
I've given many talks, and when I advise the kids, I say, don't aspire to excellence, because that's not going to be something that you're capable of with your age and experience and data. Aspire to competence. If you are competent, you are at the 80th percentile, if not 90th percentile. Because if you're working for me and you say, I will have it Wednesday, and you have it Wednesday, I would rather have that than you say, I'll have it Monday and give it to me Tuesday, even though that doesn't make sense on one level. So when you think in those terms, the amount of people who are like, if they screw things up majorly, instead of feeling guilt, just shrug their shoulders and say, well, everyone makes mistakes. Well, yes, that's factual. Everyone makes mistakes. Everyone has flaws. The fact that you're using this as a justification for any individual mistake that you might make renders you as a horrible person. Another example, like I'll meet people when I give these talks and they'll say, oh, I'm terrible with names. Well, no one's great with names. What have you tried? You have a flaw. You've identified you have a flaw. What have you tried? Well, I've tried nothing. So clear. It's like, seriously? You can't go from terrible to just mediocre with names? Like, that's not in your capacity? I used to be a huge procrastinator. Now I'm not. But one day I sat down and I'm like, wait a minute. I'm feeling that anxiety. I know I'm not going to get this work done. If I just sit down for 15 minutes, I won't be a procrastinator, and all of this emotional baggage that I thought is part of myself will go away. And it did. What?
It's just funny. Have you ever done a personality test?
INTJ.
Oh God. Whatever. Sorry. That's my, like, that is, shouldn't even be my, I didn't even have like a cover for reaction. That was just my actual reaction.
Should I say, I'm sorry. Let me speak more on your level. I'm a Cancer.
Oh my God. That's so much worse.
Typical Leo answer.
Wow. Okay. Stop. Please. I'm just being a Capricorn. Okay. anyway, Maybe after this, I'll send you. My dad has a personality test, and it's based on the big
okay,
five.
Yeah.
It's different than the Myers-Briggs. It's more scientifically accurate.
Okay, that's not saying much.
It's good. It's really good. I think you'll like it.
Yeah, no, I believe you. I'm like saying more scientific than Myers-Briggs.
No. I get that. I tried that one. It doesn't work. The science is not there, I think. So I don't know what I am. But I'll send you this one after the podcast. It's cool.
Okay, yeah. I'll definitely take it.
You'd come in low in politeness. It's agreeableness. It measures.
Yes, very low.
Very low. I'm low. I'm zero. Zero percentile.
It's a very good filter. When I meet people, I will throw out a very quickly inappropriate comment. And right away, you can tell who you're dealing with because they'll roll their eyes, which is fine, which is an acknowledgement, but not they're not going to humor my inappropriateness. The people, or they'll go with it. Yes, and comedic types. Those are people you get along with. It's the ones who pitch a fit. You're like, I can't work with this person because they're rigid in their behavior.
That's such a good quick way.
Yeah, it's a very quick, and because it'll be improv, they'll have to give you their genuine response. And they don't realize you're doing it. And they just think, and because of my, I have enough stature that I can get away with being a dick sometimes.
That's a really good idea. I don't do that at all. I do this. I don't know.
It might be different for females.
Oh, yeah, it probably is.
It might be for females.
It's weird. My dad's got a lot of I wouldn't say anti-women because he's not anti-woman at all. But he doesn't, I think, acknowledge sometimes the difficulties women have compared to men. And I've noticed them, particularly being married, because I have a close relationship with a man and now I can kind of understand it from that angle. But some things are easier. And one of the things that I find are easier, particularly me, it's like I'm on Instagram. I've got blonde hair, so nobody takes me seriously. Plus, I put up bikini photos, which doesn't help. But you get taken more seriously by everybody if you're a man, period. And then it really depends on how you look as a woman, how serious you're taken. Like if you're older and you dress more conservatively, you're taken more seriously. And if you're a man, dressing differently matters, but you're just taken more seriously. Even on the phone, even if you're talking to women, it's not like women aren't playing into that, but it's tough sometimes. Like not tough, it's, you know, mildly irritating compared to other things.
I also think that feminists are absolutely right that women are the subjects of more vitriol on social media, and the vitriol tends to be more gendered and both in intensity and in quantity than males have to deal with. And it's to hand wave this away, I think, does no one any good.
Where have you seen that? You've just seen that on social
just
media.
Just when because I'll see how followers of mine and I see how people go after them, right? And the terms people use, if it's someone who's identifiably male versus identifiably female, or the speed with which the aggression escalates. After enough time, you know, you kind of notice these patterns and it's like, okay. So, you know, when females talk about this, then if they say this is an issue, then they're shouted down like, oh, no one has it easy. Sure, no one has it easy, but it doesn't mean that everyone has it equally uneasy. This is something I've noticed, and I don't know why it's so. I think people are so knee-jerk opposed to kind of giving feminism any quarter because it's used often as a cudgel, that they will react instinctively to any kind of expression of female vulnerability with any sense of obligation to compensate for this in some way.
Interesting. Okay. Well, I agree. It is tougher in some ways. Okay. Your book, The New Right.
Yeah. Yes.
What was that about? I have ideas. I haven't read any of your books because I just found out about you and then reached out and invited you on the podcast.
You keep saying that. You don't need to say it four times, Michaela.
It's been at least
so
four times,
I've
like five maybe. But The New Right, stop laughing at me.
I could be yelling. Is that better?
No, I just turned the volume down on my computer, though. That wouldn't bug me. I wouldn't be able to see it as much. The New Right. What is? I can guess, I think. Let me guess first, actually. Okay.
Yeah.
I could be totally off. Because like I said, I haven't read the book. But...
or heard of me.
But is it... I don't even know why I'm doing this because I'm probably off, but is it talking about how the political right now has changed in regards, well, in my experience, because I used to be considered, well, I've always been like libertarianism. Oh, and I want to get into the fact that you're an anarchist, right?
I am, yeah.
I almost don't even want to continue with where I was going. I don't want to continue with where okay. I was going. Okay, anarchy. Why on earth would you assume that that's a good idea?
Because it's true. It corresponds to reality that no one has the right to assert authority over another human being without their consent.
Okay, that is true. But you also talked about how vapid people are. So wouldn't you assume that theoretically in a, I'm a libertarianism, a libertarianist? Libertarian. Wow.
I'm a libertarian.
Oh my God. Don't even. I'm in Serbia. Like I've been, there's been a lot of rakia involved.
Why doesn't
just
anyone
don't,
take this blonde bikini girl seriously?
Shit. I can edit this. I'm not going to, but I could just cut that entire thing, but I won't.
I'm a libertarianist. Just like Ayn Rand.
I'm going to keep this because I choose to. Anyway, okay. My assumption, everything I say from now on just doesn't matter. But my assumption is the vapid people you were talking about, wouldn't it be good if somebody could be in charge that actually cared about other people and was smart and could make decisions? And then they just made decisions that were better, but also let people have as much freedom as they wanted.
Yeah, so that is what you're describing as anarchy. So the vast majority of people are ballast, socially ballast. They're not really, in Nazi Germany, they would have been Nazis. In Iran right now, they'll be religious Muslims.
Yeah.
In America, they'll be boomers. They will accept the edicts of their master culture unthinkingly and proudly, and then will fight for it very vociferously. So under an anarchist system, it would be the same thing. However, things would be cheaper. They would have more options, and there'd be more opportunity for people to create and innovate. Because let's suppose there's two ways to do something, through force, meaning the state, or through freedom, meaning the markets. So let's suppose there's an issue on the table. If I delegate it to the state, that means I have one agency, whoever those people are, they have to sit down and figure out the problem. Whereas if it's decided in a free system, then literally anyone, millions if it's going to be a nation, billions if it's the world, you have billions of minds trying to solve this issue, which means the odds that someone will find, if not a solution, even a mere improvement, will be millions and billions of times higher than it would be under a state issue. So anarchism, the arguments for anarchy are the same arguments as against a single-payer healthcare system. It's the same arguments against a single-payer justice system or a single-payer security system. The logic follows suit in every way.
Okay, but don't you think it's unrealistic to expect anarchy to work out? Like, wouldn't some like macho man would just take over? Like, it's not sustainable. You'd end up with fascism instantly. The mafia would just, like, there'd just be a hierarchy, and then the mafia would take over, and then it'd be North Korea. That's what I assume.
What are presented as the strongest arguments against anarchism are inevitably descriptions of the status quo. You are regarding the state. From an anarchist perspective, the Republicans and Democrats are literally rival gangs, which simply wear different colors and have their turf warfare, and they will yell at each other in front of you and laugh at you behind your back. So what you're saying, the strongest person will assert their dominance, is in fact what is the case now. If you try not to get your protection money from the IRS, see what happens to you and your property. Under an anarchist system, there would not be this centralized force. You would have competition, and you would be able to switch from, let's suppose, Sprint to AT&T as who is your protection service provider just as easily as switching cell phones. And this would discourage this kind of brute use of force, because no one wants to see that in their neighborhoods. And in fact, every nation is in a state of anarchy toward every other nation, and they have in fact worked it out amicably for the most part.
Okay. I do see where you're coming from. I don't know if I agree. I do see where you're coming
from. We'll get you there.
Maybe. I still think, like, ideally, the problem with politics in general.
Can I just say one more thing?
Yeah,
you also said it's unrealistic. What is really unrealistic is that the Constitution will work as we've been promised despite 220 years of data to the contrary. So the Constitution has been utterly ineffective at protecting gun rights, for example, whereas gun distribution and gun proliferation is the best protection of gun rights, as opposed to some piece of paper which no one follows with any kind of literalism.
Okay. No, that's fair. But in the last, like, I haven't been home in 6 months, and I've been living like between Russia and Serbia, which were fun for like a week and a half. And I'm not saying, I mean, I was in Russia in the winter, so that obviously played a factor. And I do like Serbia, but there are parts of North America that I like desperately miss. And one of the things, and it's just something simple, is I can't ship anything here. Like if I ship something here, it requires 4 Serbian forms to fill out. And then they ask for a third. The customs fee is a third of whatever I purchased. And if it's a gift, you just can't get it. So you have to have a form that shows what you bought. Then you need to pay them in cash a third of the amount of the purchase. And that's just how it works here. And I didn't know that when I first arrived. I assumed it was like North America and you can just ship things. So I bought a couple of things and I can't get them because you can't ship things here. So I feel like, and maybe this doesn't have anything to do with politics, but I feel like the way North America is set up, like some of the underpinnings are done so well that there are things we don't even have to think about, like shipping things to ourselves.
I think that's funny that you said this as an example. I'm looking it up right now. I ordered Serbian aftershave on eBay. I ordered it on where did I order this from? May 10th, it still hasn't gotten here because the brand name is called Tobacco and the scent was wild. So Tobacco is the brand of the aftershave. There's Tobacco Wild and Tobacco Magic. Still haven't gotten it here. We actually have had an example of an anarchist post office in the States. There's someone named Lysander Spooner, who is a great abolitionist hero, great anarchist hero. And he had a private post office. And his argument was just because the Constitution allows for the government to establish a post office does not mean it forbids private competition. And his competitive post office was cheaper and more efficient than the U.S. Postal Service. So, of course, they sued him until they drove him out of business. I have just recently, I bought on eBay a letter with one of his stamps on it that was used in the 1840s. So that was pretty cool. But I don't think either of these, the U.S. or Serbia, are particular examples. They're just different types of statist mixed economies.
So you're saying the U.S. could be better?
Oh, absolutely. Basically. Of course. A lot better.
Well, that's not saying a lot right now.
I think we're doing okay.
Of course. Really?
Oh, yeah. Very happy and optimistic. Absolutely. Of course. You're not? You think things are going bad?
I don't know. I've just written off 2020. Joe Rogan just posted, or I don't know what he re-Instagrammed, that there were alien spaceships. Like, I'm done with 2020. I'm done.
Wait,
you joked about
bad?
Astrology. I'm almost at the point where I'm looking to astrologers for answers.
Wait, why is it bad that there's UFOs, if that were true?
Why would any alien come here and like help us? Why wouldn't they just exterminate everybody? Plus, we're annoying.
You Canadians, I thought you were supposed to be all nice and polite. You're like,
I told you, zero percentile.
These people are politeness. Annoying. Let's exterminate them. Are you sure you're in Serbia, not Austria? Jesus Lord. He's annoyed. Exterminate him. This guy's getting on my nerves. Exterminate him.
Okay, you've blocked everybody annoying on Twitter and you forgot.
I'm not trying to kill them.
You told me people were vapid, but you don't think they're annoying? Just vapid.
No. I'm sorry. That's not the leap. The leap isn't from vapid to annoying. The leap is from annoying to exterminate. That's the leap.
I said aliens would exterminate. I don't want to exterminate people.
No, but you're saying you would empathize with a population that wanted to exterminate an annoying race.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Jesus, like termites? You want termites in your house? No. You move into a new house. What if you move into a new house that's already occupied by termites? Don't you exterminate them? What if they view us like termites? I don't even know why we're on this topic, but that's what I'm saying.
That's literally a Farrakhan said. Did you know that? He said, I'm not an anti-Semite, I'm anti-termite. You probably should edit out this little section because this is not doing...
I'm not editing out anything.
You're not doing so good today, kiddo. Man, you... Eastern Europe really suits you well, huh?
I've been in Eastern Europe for way too long. It's like a week. I was like, oh, this is great. There are lights everywhere. And then I could see, yeah. Huh.
I don't think, we don't know that if they're manned, these ships. And it was Stephen Hawking, the late great physicist, who did make the point that like we shouldn't be so eager to have interstellar contact, because if you look at the history of American explorers, you know, it doesn't always end up being so nice for the population that is pioneered.
Right. Well, what are they going to do? Like make all this work traveling around and then they're going to come and help us? Like, really? Well, I guess like maybe, but it seems very unlikely.
But you traveled to Eastern Europe to get help.
Yeah, I know. But like one of the doctors here was literally looked at us and was like, why are you here? Literally. And we were like, because North America is not great for something. Sorry, please help us. But that was a question. It was, why are you here? Dead serious. I was like, yeah, fuck, I don't know. 2020.
Was that the motherland? 2020 is going to get better for you, I promise. I'm telling
really?
You.
Really? Yes. According to the astrologers, it's not.
Well, we're going to find... Okay, good. This is going to be a scientific test. I'm telling you it's going to be good between now and December. The astrologers say no. We're going to check in January 1st.
Okay,
and
that sounds
whoever's
good.
Wrong gets to exterminate the other one.
No.
And their family.
I'm not into exterminating or generational punishment. No.
As we agreed.
No way.
Will we feed them to the lions?
Yeah. Okay, well, I'm going to wrap this up.
Yes,
but
ma'am.
That was really fun. Thank you. I needed some
Thank
laughs.
Thank you so much.
That was, yeah. So... thank you for coming on. And where can people find you?
I'm like AIDS. I'm everywhere. Twitter.com/MichaelMalice is probably the best bet.